I'm Celeste Headlee. This is On Second Thought. For as long as this country has had a president, African Americans have worked in the White House, and especially in the kitchen. But they're often left out of the history books. My next guest wants to change that. Adrian Miller is the author of The President's Kitchen Cabinet, The Stories of African Americans Who Fed Our First Families from the Washingtons to the Obamas. And he'll speak tonight at the Jimmy Carter Presidential Library and Museum in Atlanta. Hello there.
Hi, good to be with you.
Well, you're going to be at the Carter Center, so let's talk about Jimmy Carter first.
Sure.
Because he didn't like peas,
right?
Which is odd because Georgia is famous for its field peas, right?
Yeah.
Tell me about the kind of things that Jimmy Carter had served up for him.
So I think he was very influential in having grits put on the daily menu at the White House. So I wrote a story about that. But a lot of Southern food. In fact, when the Carters were moving in, there's a recorded conversation from the chefs saying, I hope the Carters like Southern food because that's what we serve pretty much every day. Because there's the menu for the cooking for guests and others, but there's also the menu for the resident staff, which was primarily black.
Oh, that makes perfect sense to me. And it's one of the things, that the sort of wrinkles that you bring forward in the book that we don't really think about. But there's other things as well. It's like... And you include, one of the things I love is you include, we're not just talking about the chefs, you're also talking about the butlers and the servers as well. Why is it important to talk about those people who aren't, some of them aren't even cooking the food?
Right, because it was a team effort in order to make the first families happy, comfortable, and healthy. And so you had the people cooking the food, but also, you know, there was a lot of interaction finding out what did the president and the first family like. And making sure that they got the food that they really wanted. So there's really a team aspect to this. That's why I thought it'd be great to expand the story beyond just the kitchen. And also, what happens when the president travels?
Okay, so let's actually hear from one of a big character in your book, Zephyr Wright.
Yes.
Cooked for President Lyndon Johnson for almost 30 years in the White House. In an oral history recording, she's talking about Johnson's battle with his weight.
I wrote him a note and told him that he had been my boss for a number of years, and he always wanted to lose weight, but yet he would do nothing about it. Now I was going to be his boss. Eat what I put in front of him, don't complain, and don't ask for any more. You know, he did pretty good for a while.
See, now this is a side of Johnson we don't often... see,
right?
This African-American woman telling him what he's going to eat, when, and how much.
Oh, it goes even deeper than that. So not only was she keeping him on his diet, but a lot of times he would show up late and demand to have be fed and also to also have his guests fed. And she would say, well, you just go sit in the kitchen and wait for me to do it. And
let's actually hear her talking about that. Yeah. We have a clip of her. This is a part of an oral history featured in NPR story by the Kitchen Sisters.
The first night that I met President Johnson, it was late as usual. He was always late for meals. Now, there have been times that he'd get on the phone himself and call me and ask me how long would it take me to get something ready for the whole cabinet. And sometime he'd walk in with him and you didn't even know he was coming.
How? Tell us about this Zephyr Wright and... I mean, she seemed fierce.
Yes, she was fierce, and she was in many ways a reluctant and an active civil rights advocate. So reluctant is that when the Johnsons were going back and forth between Texas and D.C., she would ride along with the family, but she suffered so many indignities riding through the Jim Crow South that she actually stopped going on those trips. So when Johnson was pushing for the 1964 Civil Rights Act, he actually used her stories to persuade members of Congress to support the legislation. And when he signed the bill, he gave her one of the pens saying, you deserve this as much as anyone. And the ways that she was an advocate for civil rights is that she was often doing as much cooking as the White House executive chef. So when they fired the White House executive chef, a French guy named René Verdon, because he wasn't doing the cooking the way they wanted, she asked for to be paid the same wages, and she got it.
And she has a popovers. He seemed to love popovers.
Yes.
Now, you only included a couple dozen recipes in there. Why so few?
Mainly because it's really more about the history and the story of these cooks. So I didn't want it to have a cookbook feel necessarily. So I tried to pick choice recipes that I thought accentuated the story.
So we're going to talk more about her because I imagine it's going to take us a few minutes. But tell me about Daisy McAfee Bonner.
Yes. So Daisy Bonner was a cook when Franklin Delano Roosevelt would come to Warm Springs, Georgia. So she was basically lent by a family to cook for FDR. And she got him hooked on all kinds of Southern specialties. Like Country Captain, a chicken curry dish. But one thing that FDR loved was pig's feet. he loved them so much that he actually served them to Winston Churchill in the White House. And we know this because one of the black butlers wrote about it in his memoirs.
Now, how did she prepare pig's feet?
So what she would do is she would broil them, split them, and then butter them. But in the White House,
that
he served...
That is not good for you. Yeah.
In the White House, the recipe he served to Winston Churchill was sweet and sour pig's feet.
That's interesting. Okay, so one of the things, some of the things that you note in there are some little known, we only have a minute here before we take a break, but one of the things I wanted to point to was the fact in the changing of who pays the salary. Originally, presidents themselves paid the salaries of their personal staff until Harry Truman. What difference did that make?
So that made a tremendous difference because before then, you pretty much had to be a wealthy man in order to be president of the United States because you had to carry the expense of entertaining and paying your staff. We've had presidents of limited means. And usually what they would do to make up for those costs, like Lincoln and Ulysses S. Grant, is they would raid the army commissary in order to get the groceries. But they had gardening and other stuff like that. But for the most part, you had to be wealthy in order to just carry on the duties, the social duties of being president.
And they might have been able to afford larger staffs after Harry Truman when that all changed.
Yes, absolutely.
We're talking with James Beard Award-winning author Adrian Miller, so well known for finding the hidden history of our food and writing it in a way that's it's just really entertaining. His latest book is The President's Kitchen Cabinet, the stories of African Americans who fed our first families from the Washingtons to the Obamas. And Adrian speaks tonight at the Carter Center in Atlanta. So let's talk a little bit about another... We talked about salaries, so let's talk about another monetary exchange that sort of not only reflected changes in society, but made a big difference, and that was the tipping of White House staff. How did tipping change, and what did that mean?
So White House workers typically are low pay, especially the African Americans. So tipping was a way to just kind of get supplemental income. And so depending on the first family, tipping was encouraged or sometimes discouraged. And I think Mamie Eisenhower actually banned tipping. And that did not go over well with the African-American staff. So, again, it's just a reflection of just kind of less appreciation for the work that African-Americans were doing. So the supplemental income helped.
And to a certain extent, it seemed to have been a disconnect on her part from what her staff really needed. She didn't seem to truly understand that they needed that. That was part of their income.
Right, exactly. And so, you know, I often talk about how these African-American workers in the White House gave our presidents and first families a window on black life. And sometimes presidents chose to open that window and relate and understand the times, and most times they didn't. And so I think that's just one example of, as you well put it, the disconnect.
So let's hear a little bit about, it's great to have this oral history from Zephyr Wright. Here she is. This is an exchange. So we hear not just Zephyr's voice, but the voice of LBJ's social secretary, Juanita Roberts. And Roberts asks if President Johnson enjoys eating beans.
What would you say if you were asked that question by a responsible person?
Oh, I would say yes.
And
they're going to ask what kind, is it?
No, but I know that he particularly likes pork and beans.
He likes pork and beans, he likes pinto beans, he likes lima beans, green beans.
That's green limas are dried.
Green limas.
I love that. What are some of the other favorite foods of presidents?
So, for instance, George Washington loved green peas. He loved them so much.
Jimmy Carter hated.
Yeah. He loved them so much his contemporaries called him P. Diddy. I don't know if you knew that. No, I'm just kidding.
That is not true. I was like, I did not read that anywhere in the book.
Other interesting examples, LBJ loved barbecue, Tex-Mex, a lot of Southern food.
He's Nixon, Texan, yeah.
Yeah, Nixon loved cottage cheese with ketchup.
What?
Yes. And Ford even had it with A1 sauce.
Oh,
yeah.
God.
And then we know about Reagan loving mac and cheese and jelly beans.
Yeah, jelly beans we all knew about.
But he loved mac and cheese and meatloaf.
So basically, these chefs had to be incredible planners because not only were they cooking regularly for very differing numbers of people, they also had to plan travel.
Yes.
So that the first family always had the foods that they like. And they also had to sort of know what to keep in the kitchen at all times.
Exactly. And they also had to know the dietary restrictions of not only the president, but other members of the first family and guests. So it was very complicated planning. So usually the executive chef or whoever was running the White House kitchen would consult with the first lady and maybe even the chief usher or steward just to make sure that everything's planned out well. And then when they do a state dinner, they actually have to consult with the State Department to know the dietary restrictions of the honored guest. So,
these were highly trained professionals, even going back to the times of Washington. And we sometimes forget in history that there was this whole class of African Americans who were not uneducated and unskilled. They were very highly educated. Some of them, you write, studied in Europe.
Right. So the chef for Thomas Jefferson, who never was a White House chef because he never came to the White House, but when Jefferson was minister to France, his name is James Hemings, one of the older brothers of Sally Hemings. He actually spends 3 years being trained as a classical French chef and becomes Jefferson's chef in residence while he's in Paris.
So tell me a little bit about some of these other stories. You have these great tidbits. For example, they have if they serve fries on Air Force One, they're always soggy.
Right. So what I didn't know, and it makes complete sense, is that on Air Force One, you can't fry because it's unsafe to fry while
right.
So often what they do is they kind of pre-make the food at Andrews Air Force Base, and then they reheat it on the plane. So, you know, for a lot of times the food was just kind of military chow, but I understand that in the Obama administration, the food kind of took a notch up.
I wonder why that is.
Yeah, I don't know.
So, but also there's this thing that you talk about, which I also found fascinating, which is the lesser P. What's a lesser P?
So I think a lot of people will relate to this. It's when you ask a cook for their recipe and they purposely leave something out so you can't make it the way they did. And Zephyr Wright was famous for that. They just leave one thing out, right?
Right, but was it a key ingredient?
No, it's usually something that just added a little spice or, you know, made it really taste good. But yeah, they would just leave it out on purpose.
So we've got just a little bit of time left. Tell me a recipe that you think from the book, because like I said, there's only a couple dozen. Tell me one that you would recommend people start with.
So I really love a recipe called Jerk Pita Pizza. It was done by Charlie Redden, who was the executive chef of the White House Mess, which is a space in the White House for senior staff. And essentially you get some chicken, you cook it, and then you toss it in some jerk sauce. And then you use your pita as the base. And then you just add the pizza parts on it, you know, call the components. It's really good.
That is Adrian Miller, food historian, soul food historian as well, winner of the James Beard Award. His latest book chronicles the stories of African Americans in the White House kitchen. And it is called The President's Kitchen Cabinet, The Stories of African Americans Who Fed Our First Families. Adrian speaks tonight in Atlanta at the Carter Center. Thank you so much.
Thank you.